This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Tuesday, April 23rd. Another obstacle in the federal government's plan to buy back thousands of guns from Canadians. Canada Post is refusing to recover them. Exclusive details just ahead. And Saskatchewan taxpayers will still get the full carbon rebate, even though the province stopped collecting the tax on home heating. The federal minister of environment is here to defend that decision. Plus, the prime minister and his cabinet are crisscrossing the country to sell their budget. But are Canadians buying it? We've got a fresh new look at how voters are feeling. We begin, though, with an exclusive story. The federal government's plan to buy back thousands of assault-style guns has hit a snag. The program is already years behind schedule, and now sources say Canada Post is refusing to collect and transport the weapons. Daniel LeBlanc is with Radio Canada, and he joins me now. Okay, so you've been speaking to federal sources about this refusal to for this to go ahead. What have you learned about what's going on?
So basically, the buyback program goes back to 2020 after Portapique. The government bans 1,500 types of military weapons. They estimate that there are about 140,000 minimum of these guns that have been banned across the country. People cannot use them. People cannot sell them. They've got to store them securely. It's been 4 years, and so there are questions as to how the government will get those guns back, destroy them, and compensate people for the money they've basically lost by, you know, having to forfeit those guns. Canada Post was a key partner in the government's efforts to recuperate these guns. In the eyes of the government, they would send boxes to people. People would put their guns into the boxes, bring them back to the post office, and, you know, the people would then, the guns would then be shipped back and destroyed. Canada Post has recently told the government, no way, this is a line in the sand. We don't want to go there. The main concern seems to be the interactions at the post offices. Not everyone who has a gun that's been banned is happy with this government decision, and Canada Post is invoking the security of its employees. And so that's why, you know, they're kind of moving back. The government says they're still working with a bunch of different potential partners to buy back the guns. One of the issues is who will these partners be? Canada Post could be used to transport the guns after someone else has received them.
Right.
The Prime Minister today says, you know, he's still upbeat about the program, still wants to compensate people so we can listen to him.
We are going to do everything to make sure they remain illegal and that people be fairly compensated for something they bought back when it was perfectly legal to do so. And we'll work with a broad range of partners.
Okay, it's interesting. The government wanted to treat these guns kind of like any other piece of mail, right? That they'd mail out the box, you'd fill it, bring in the box, and Canada Post would ship it back. So there's this refusal now and lack of clarity about where it goes. So what's been some of the reaction on the different sides of this debate?
So some people in government are quite angry at Canada Post, saying they're hypocritical of they ship guns, but they don't want to take them in. They already have got some clear expertise in handling guns and firearms. Other complaints from a group called Poly Remembers, so people who were at Polytechnique during the 1989 massacre, feminicide, in which 14 women were killed. They argue that the government needs to be tougher with Canada Post, that there's no real excuse for the government, for Canada Post not to participate in a government program. They kind of downplay the security concerns, saying, you know, there are obvious ways around them. Maybe if there's a need for security at post offices, that can be handled. But also that the people who bring the guns to Canada Post would not necessarily be the ones who don't want to give them back. That would
right.
be another step. So right. we can hear Nathalie Prévost, who survived the Polytechnique massacre in 1989.
It's a surprise and a real deception. Canada Post is a public society. So in my understanding, they have to answer not only the government's will, but also the public's will. And this this law has been approved by more than 80% of Canadians, and we want it to be applied. So we don't really understand this position from Canada Post.
And so, you know, this is still a heated political debate. The Conservative Party did not provide anyone to speak on the record on camera today, at least on my side. But, you know, they say there's no need to do a buyback program. First off, it's property rights, but also that there's countless illegal guns in Canada which will not be affected by the buyback program. There's an issue of timeline. You know, when the government promises to do this by the next election scheduled for the fall of 2025, right. I do think it needs to be done before that. Otherwise, the Conservatives would not implement the buyback. So or if it doesn't happen, will it be an election issue? There's still a lot to come on this story. But what's obvious is the buyback program is not going as roundly as it was assumed in 2020 when it was launched.
Of all the challenges the Liberals have had on this file, I never expected Canada Post to be one of them. Danielle LeBlanc, thank you so much for this reporting. Appreciate
Thanks.
It. There were some chaotic scenes at Queen's Park today as Ontario MPPs debated whether to overturn the ban on wearing the keffiyeh at the provincial legislature. The keffiyeh is a scarf commonly worn by Arabs, and it holds special significance to Palestinians as a symbol of resistance, and it's been seen on pro-Palestinian demonstrators recently as they protest the Israel-Hamas war. It has become a flashpoint, and here's how some of today's debate played out.
I seek unanimous consent that this House acknowledge that the keffiyeh is a culturally significant clothing item to many in Ontario's Palestinian, Muslim, and Arab communities.
Agreed?
Yes.
Heard some no's.
We gave him a chance again today to do the right thing and reverse it, yet again his Conservative members have said no.
We have amongst us the most diverse caucus in the history of this province.
This House stands in recess for 15 minutes.
I come from a caucus that is the most diverse caucus in the history of this province. I don't take any lessons from the Leader of the Opposition when it comes to how people, marginalized people, feel. I'm an Italian-Canadian who in the 1970s was spit on for being a wop. I don't need any lessons from her on what it means to stand up for marginalized people. I do it every single day, and so do the rest of my caucus mates, and we bring people together. We don't divide them.
Okay, for more on this, we're joined by Sabrina Nanji of the Queen's Park Observer from Toronto. Sabrina, quite the day at Queen's Park. We heard protesters there. The House adjourned for a while. I mean, what's going on at Queen's Park?
Yeah, you're right, David. I mean, we talked about this just last week, mm-hmm. and the conflict in the Middle East continues to scramble provincial politics as it's done, you know, in other parts of the world. And we sort of saw things descend into chaos today at Queen's Park. This was the second attempt by the New Democrats to overturn the speaker's ban on wearing the keffiyeh in the legislature. As we know, the speaker says this is too overtly political. And you know, as the referee, the speaker in the House, like it's sort of his job to decide, you know, whether things are too political. MPPs have to even ask for unanimous consent to wear things like hockey jerseys or those daffodil pins for cancer awareness. And it seems that this time around with the keffiyeh ban, obviously the NDP's motion failed, but all eyes were really on the Conservative benches to see what the Tories would do, because as we know, last week, Premier Doug Ford and his party had attempted to whip the vote on the NDP's first motion to reverse this ban. And now he's singing a different tune, right? He appeared to at least admit defeat and allowed his caucus, which this has, you know, created a rift within his caucus, a free vote on the controversial ban rather than whipping the vote, which he tried to do last week. We know the premier came out and said that the speaker's ban on the keffiyeh is too divisive. This is all happening against the backdrop of a by-election in Milton, where there's a big, thriving Muslim community. So obviously this has become a lightning rod, really, at Queen's Park. We had some folks protesting wearing the keffiyeh in the public galleries there. The speaker had to call a 15-minute recess in the middle of question period just so everyone could cool off. The Tories were walking out en masse and, you know, are really voicing their displeasure with how this has all played out. And Doug Ford, you know, after his caucus meeting today, said that they're a big family, they have different disagreements, and he's now willing to, I guess, allow some of that dissent because we saw more MPPs say no to that motion than we did last week. So certainly I think they're feeling emboldened a little bit too.
Well, let's just talk about that, because when we spoke last week, you had suggested there were more MPPs in the Conservative caucus who were uncomfortable with allowing the keffiyeh to be worn. It was Robin Martin from Eglinton and Lawrence, who we know for sure denied the unanimous consent motion, and Robin Martin issued a statement today saying she was going to keep opposing this, you know, as long as it came up. How much bigger did that get? Do we have a sense of the number of how large the disagreement with the premier is on this issue inside that caucus?
Yeah, I mean, I have heard from at least a dozen MPPs who aren't happy about this. Whether or not they want to go on record is another story. But yet, we did hear, I think maybe about five or six Tories, at least, you know, from my perch, say no to this right. ban. And Robin Martin has sort of been the face of this opposition, right? And she did put out a statement saying that she's not afraid of the political consequences she might face. My sources have been telling me that at least last week, you know, the orders from the powers that be, the premier's office, was that if you were going to do this, you weren't supporting, you know, the NDP's motion, sit this one out, and I guess keep your opposition on the down low. It seems that Doug Ford has heard a lot of concerns from his caucus. Some members include Andrea Kanjian, Goldie Gamari, Lisa McLeod is now, you know, speaking up a little more publicly. And I think that he's now wanting to at least allow his caucus a free vote on this. But at the end of the day, you know, they're still defying the premier's orders, at least what he said publicly, because he has called for the speaker to reverse this ban, saying it's too divisive, whereas clearly his MPPs don't agree with him and they at least feel more willing to speak out against him publicly. And you know, this is kind of maybe inside baseball, but for caucus health, I think this might be a good thing. But I don't think that the premier is going to hear the end of this anytime soon from a lot of his members.
No, it's interesting that the premier can't whip his caucus, and the speaker says he'll only overturn his ruling if there's a unanimous vote in the House, which seems impossible under the circumstances you've laid out. So the speaker can reverse this at any point, but is waiting for the House to direct him to do that. But meanwhile, I saw images today of MPP Sarah Jama, formerly of the NDP, now an independent, still censured, as I understand it, and unable to sort of speak in Queen's Park, but wearing the keffiyeh on the floor of the legislature in defiance of the ban. Did the speaker do anything about this? I know they're stopping people from coming into the building, but what about an MPP wearing this on the floor?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Sarah Jama obviously, you know, got booted amid this controversy in the Middle East. She was kicked out of the NDP caucus more so for insubordination of her leader, but certainly that was for her, you know, it sort of stemmed from her comments on Israel, which she had twice had to apologize for. When we asked Speaker Ted Arnott about this, he said that he just didn't see Jama wearing the keffiyeh in the House. You know, she sits at the very end. She's sort of like the last row and very far away from him. And the speaker said, you know, he's not like coming into the House, you know, eagle-eyed, laser focused on what MPPs are wearing. But I do think that if she continues to do it, it could be problematic for her. And you're right, she's already censured. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, this clearly, she's trying to take a stand and she's trying to make a statement here. But I do think that because these are the rules that the speaker has laid out, because it seems like it could be impossible to get unanimous consent to turn this around, that Sarah Jama, you know, could be facing consequences for this. But right now, I think just because the speaker said he didn't see it, I think she's safe for now.
Okay. Look, we're tight on time, but one last quick question. We're about 9 days away from that Milton by-election, if I've done my math correctly. I think it's next Thursday it happens. There's a big Muslim population there. What is your sense of where this issue, how this issue is resonating in that race? And is the government concerned about this in terms of maybe losing a seat?
Yeah, I mean, we just saw fresh polling today from Main Street that puts the Liberals and the Conservatives neck and neck. I think the Liberals were like, you know, overtaking the Conservatives just, you know, by a hair. And so this is a really close race in Milton, and the Conservatives obviously want to keep this seat. I think that this issue is resonating certainly in the riding, but at some point, I think, you know, the question becomes, are you just being pandered to if you're in the Muslim community? You know, where does even the Jewish community turn to at this point? Because all major leaders have said they want the reversal on the keffiyeh ban. So I think that some folks are saying, you know, well, we've got to, you know, hear and take into account what the Muslim voters want. But we've got other folks who are saying, well, what about the Jewish community and what about our Jewish voters? So really, this has exposed division at Queen's Park, and I don't think it's going to let up anytime soon. But like you said, the by-election is a week away, so we're going to see how it all plays out.
All right, Sabrina, always appreciate it when you join us. That's Sabrina Nanji of the Queen's Park Observer from Toronto. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
The Liberal government's pitch to sell their budget and change their fortunes continues across the country today.
To unlock a path to a safe, secure, comfortable middle-class life for all Canadians, particularly the young Canadians who today feel that that is out of reach.
But that message doesn't seem to be having much of an effect on the polls. In the days after the budget was tabled, Ipsos shows the Conservatives held a 19-point lead over the Conservatives, plus a third of Canadians say they would never vote Liberal in the next election. Abacus data shows no movement in the polls in favor of the Liberals in the days following their pre-budget announcements, and no movement in any of the core trackers for the two younger age cohorts. So, have the Liberals missed a chance to take a bite out of the Conservatives' polling lead with Budget 2024, or could the message need more time to sink in? We're going to talk about that with the Tuesday Power panel. Emily Nicola is a columnist with Le Devoir. Michelle Cadario is a former Liberal campaign director. Françoise Boivin is a former NDP MP. And Kate Harrison is a Conservative political analyst. Good to see you all. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle, let's start with you. The main target of this budget, as the Liberals have told us again and again and again, are millennials and Gen Zs. If the polling is to be believed, nothing has moved, but are millennials and Gen Zs seeing the budget in real time with the way they consume news, or do we need to wait longer for more targeted digital strategies, or does this just miss them entirely?
Well, I think first we have to put it in context. These polls, you know, one of them was actually taken before the budget was actually tabled. So I'm not saying that anything has fundamentally changed, and I doubt that the top line numbers will change. What you want to see is, are the underlying numbers softening, right? When you're this far behind, that's what you're looking for, are the key indicators. And so some of the things I saw in that, true, the numbers who are not going to consider the Liberals is not great. But the Conservatives are only 5 points beneath that. So that gap, that delta, is actually quite tight compared to what the top line number party line thing is. So that's something to be looking for. And again, you want to be looking at some of the issue sets, some of the more detailed things, because that's going to move first. And that's going to say if you made your mark. What I'll also say, though, is how are people going to see it if there's no advertising behind it, right? Yeah. And so, you know, I hope that this would be a strategy that they've laid out. It's a path forward that's not going to be just kind of a one-time thing. You drop the announcement, the press release goes out, and it's into the trash bin and on to the next thing. It has to be repeated over and over using every bit of free media that you and earned media that you absolutely can. And then you got to put some weighted paid behind it so that people who we want to see it, those targeted people, see those messages that are key to them. So, you know, you can't just do it as one shot and think that it's going to be an answer.
Right.
If they actually have a full strategy, this will be just one part that should go forward.
Well, Emily, this is what I'm wondering about in terms of reaching that younger cohort of voters, much younger than me, as you are. It's more of a digital strategy play, and I'm sure it's not showing up in my algorithms because I'm going to be 51 soon, and that's not who they're appealing to right now. So how do we assess their effectiveness at reaching the younger generation? Do we jump to conclusions based on what we've seen in the polls, or does this need more time to marinate in terms of reaching them? I don't know. What's your sense?
First of all, I love how you're using your power, the powers invested in you as a CBC host, to try to make Gen Z a thing that people say.
I have to speak Canadian English, or I get yelled at and hated. So, and being from Newfoundland, I already get enough complaints about how I say stuff.
Sure. I wish you good luck on that journey. That being said, I do see some of the Justin Trudeau's Instagram posts get pushed my way. I see when you're on Instagram a lot, what you're seeing is that the Liberal the Liberal videos are overproduced for the Instagram feel. The classic video of a politician walking towards a camera, feeling very confident and cocky, you know, with a smile and telling you those messages, that works great for a TV ad. It sounds off for Instagram. Hmm. Instagram is more, hey, I'm taking 30 seconds in my busy day to tell you something that's very genuine. and then I'm going to go back to my day. And it looks ugly, but that's what makes it real. So I'm making a bit of a caricature here, but it's overproduced, and that makes it come across as fake. The second thing is that Chrystia Freeland, in terms of her communication style, not the greatest person to put forward to trying to talk to Gen Z. And
it's working. It's working.
And millennials. And the millennials. That's just not the greatest spokesperson to speak to that generation and to trying to have an emotional connection and relatability. So the Justin Trudeau has a team. If he wants to deploy communication strategy that's going to reach younger people, I know it's the tradition to have the finance minister take the lead. But if you're trying to reach young people, I think it could be a team effort.
Yeah, and Francoise, I think that's what they were trying to do in the run-up to the budget, because it felt like it was Sean Fraser's budget for about 2 weeks there, as he was sort of the headline minister at a lot of different things. But I have no clear sense whether they've actually reached younger Canadians with this at this point in time. They have angered a lot of corporate Canadians and incorporated Canadians and wealthier Canadians with the capital gains tax changes, and they've gotten pushback on that. Has that in any way, do you think, crowded things out in terms of them trying to deliver this message of hope?
Well, first, I would like to say, when was the last time we all got excited and happy because of a filing of a budget? I'm looking down decades, and I've rarely seen anybody saying, rejoicing and saying, hey, look, the budget is talking to me, the budget is doing this, and the budget is doing that. So I think we're doing a way too much focus day to day on the budget. The strategy for the Liberals, I think, for the last 2-3 weeks was to let's talk in the public sphere, because Mr. Poilievre was getting all the attention with his rallies and so on. And for a couple of weeks, we saw much more Liberals coming out and talking about different things to come. Now they filed the budget. If they believe in their budget, and I have no reason to believe that they don't, they need to do two things. They need to definitely focus, and they need to get some results that they can really promote instead of just plain air and possibilities. They need the economy to, and that they have no control or not too much on, to improve inflation, interest rates, and so on. They need the mood to change in the country. Because when I look at the polls and I see the numbers, and I see we get all excited because one party gets 43%, then you have to apply in each provinces and where do those votes goes and so on and so forth. But even on the budget and the impression of people, still 28% had zero or didn't want to voice their opinion. And of the 72% left, it's pretty kif-kif between I don't really care and I'm giving thumbs down. Right. And some will really give a thumbs up. So that's why I go back to my initial proposition. Liberals, if you want to make any possible gain next year when the election comes, if it comes in 2025 like it's supposed to be, well, focus and get some results, because nothing talk more than results. If there's more housing available, it's a tall task. But they kind of paint themselves in that corner, and they will have to live with it. And I say campaign matters. Yes. So when there'll be 30-some days, that's when the youth and even the olders like you, David, we are actually glued to their words in that period of time, and anything can happen. So still a lot of fun to come in politics.
No, I'll be sitting here with a blanket wrapped around my legs watching the campaign ferociously. But, Kate, one of the things the Liberals were hoping to do, it seems, with this campaign was to draw the Conservatives in on what will you cut.
For sure.
And a fight on the capital gains tax. That contrast between them, this is, you know, what you use, inflection points for, to try to sharpen that contrast. On the tax stuff, it doesn't seem... I don't know what the conservatives are going to do, but they're not going to take the bait, is what it seems. They have not responded or engaged in this in any kind of a way.
Yeah, and this very much was a budget designed to be a conversation around that, and the polling so far has indicated that Canadians weren't all that interested in having that conversation. They wanted to have a conversation about affordability. Mm-hmm. Some of the Ipsos polling, really interestingly, when you ask Canadians, you know, do you think you'll be better off as a result of this budget? 45% say, no, I won't be. And that was the piece that I think was really missing from the budget is, okay, what is in here that gets at the day-to-day affordability piece? Yes, there's the conversation around housing. We've talked before, that's more of a medium-term play that doesn't provide relief tomorrow or the next day. So that kind of retail piece was missing. I think Francoise has a point in terms of this idea of a post-budget bump and glow is a bit fictitious. It's kind of like looking to a cabinet shuffle to solve all of your political problems or, you know, making a modification around the carbon tax. And like, that's the solve. That's all that we need to do. This has been brewing for so long, this trajectory for the Liberals. And there's that trust deficit. And my co-panelists have some great ideas in terms of advertising. I think that's a good suggestion, and that focus and that discipline. But the elephant in the room is that, no cap, Justin Trudeau has lost his riz. He's not able to connect with the Gen Z anymore. He doesn't have the ability to authentically relate to them. So no matter what he says, it's going to fall on deaf ears.
You know, and just to follow up on that, I mean, I agree with you. A budget in normal times is not going to be a game changer in any way. It's the way this one was done, this campaign style approach of a government that has lost control of the narrative and the day-to-day news agenda, trying to regain control of it. And for a while, they did that, at least in terms of driving what news content and conversations was about, but maybe it's just the way people consume information now and how they've tuned out from traditional media that it's not getting through.
It's part of that, but it was also a deliberate choice on the part of the Liberals to make Budget Day about this capital gains tax. Mm-hmm. I think that they overestimated the public desire to see businesses and individuals taxed more to pay for Liberal promises as opposed to seeing the Liberals spend less. So that was a choice, and I think it was a strategic miscalculation on their part.
So, Michelle, where do you go from here? I know you've talked about the advertising, and this is something the party may not have the money it needs to do advertising at the scale it would like to do to counter what Mr. Poilievre and the Conservatives are able to do. And they've really, since 2015, kind of said no way to the kind of like Canada's Economic Action Plan advertising we used to see under the Harper government. So it takes the public funds away from you and your ability even to do informational advertising that could veer into the political branding thing. So what do you do as a government right now if this was the shot you shot and may have missed?
Keep your aim and keep your focus, to be honest. It's a long, you got to play the long game. You know, what's the ad? You have to say things 1,000 times for 50 people to hear it once. And you've got to keep that kind of old adage in mind, even more so now when, you know, the media and how people consume things is so disparate. You know, they need to have that kind of multi-level strategy going after the various target groups. And they need to focus in, with the right messenger, as Emily was saying, and the right message. And they can't just lose focus now and jump to the next thing. Otherwise, you'll never get it across. So it's a huge challenge to keep the news fresh on the things that they want to talk about. No one does anything without a good amount of polling behind it. It is curious that Mr. Poilievre is choosing to say nothing once again on absolutely all of these issues. Fair enough. At some point, he's going to have to. You know, he's kind of getting the benefit of the doubt of the people think that he's going to get rid of the capital gains tax and reduce it again. I don't know. I doubt it. He certainly hasn't promised it. But we'll see. But at some point, you know, there's going to be that. You've got to keep trying to drive those wedges because that's what keeps the conversation going. And the fact that we're still talking about the capital gains a week later is a win in their column because that was actually something, a tax measure from the last budget. So, you know, that it was a deliberate conversation that they wanted Canadians to have.
But I wonder, Francoise, just on that, and going back to what you said about Finance Minister Freeland, we're still talking about it, but it's because it's being rebranded as a tax on innovation, a tax on doctors, a tax on retirements, which may or may not be what it is because, you know, people have complex financial structures. And while they may have wanted this to be sort of a wedge that they can drive in and make it about class and generational fairness, against all of this pushback, they've been trying to minimize the consequences of it, which makes it sound smaller than I think they need it to be the wedge that actually drives into that hole, right? So, like, how do you prosecute that when you're trying to make the argument you're a good steward of the economy as well?
Well, somebody was sleeping at the wheel in my book because, it, in a sense, they should have known that there would be some pushback. They wanted the narrative, if I'm correct, to be we're taxing the rich, those who've got properties, not the, we're not taxing the residents, the principal residents, and so on and so forth. Now you get the doctors in, you get all type of people. I've got people writing to me every day. One guy is a farmer and he invested in some real estate and that's his pension fund for when he's done working so hard. So those are maybe things that they didn't foresee in some aspect, or maybe they're not even covered. I don't know. I'm not a specialist, but they should have sell it better. And know beforehand that those cases would come out. I mean, don't make me bleed with the doctors who are incorporated, like in Quebec, where they get all type of advantages to be doing so, not like us lame people who are not doctors, who pay some full price just to get real estate. Governments help them to set shop and be able to see public. And good for that, because we need them to act. But then they become a corporation, they get more money, and so on and so forth. So the government, sometimes they've got great ideas. They don't look too far away. They don't analyze in depth. And then when something comes like this, they look like people who are not ready, who don't know what they're talking about. And Emily, I think, was saying that Chrystia Freeland is not their best communicator. And there, if there's one thing, your finance minister must be one of your best, because all the trust and faith in the budget lies on their shoulder. So if she's not their best communicator, they've got a problem right then and there.
So Emily, to pick up on something that Michelle had said, you know, I've seen conservatives asked about the capital gains tax many, many, many times, and I don't know what they're going to do. I know they want to axe the carbon tax, fix the budget, build the homes, stop the crime. That's kind of cut the CBC, and that's kind of where it ends, right? In terms of clarity. So how sustainable is that now with the runway we have left to an election, and these sort of, whether they're big enough wedges or not, these specific things being put on the table, that visible and loud and vocal cohorts of the population are weighing in on, for the opposition and the government front runners not to take clear positions on these things. How sustainable is that, do you think?
There's two things. On the Liberal side, for the wedges to actually be wedges, they need to be strongly claimed as wedges and not trying to meet people in the middle. Which is hard to do when you're liberal, because you're a centrist by DNA. Mm-hmm. But if you're going for the tax the rich thing, which I can guarantee you, there's very few millennials and Gen Z who feel attacked by the capital gain thing. Right. If you're really trying to get those people to vote for you, you should not be shying away from using the tax the rich narrative that you had planned to do, even if it makes some doctors unhappy. I don't know a lot of people under the age of 35 who will feel sorry for the specialist who has created this great structure that allows them to not pay a lot of taxes. I don't think there's a lot of sympathy for that when you're not affording a home. So I think they need to understand that they're not going to make everyone happy with this narrative, which one, again, runs against the DNA of a party that calls itself the natural governing party and the one that can bring all Canadians together in an age of polarized politics. That's not what their political reflexes are. And on the Conservative Party, there is a game changer that can happen in the sense that now they are not necessarily that much forced to have not only just criticism, but actually policies. As we were, if we were heading towards a campaign, they'll have to have a program at some point. And so that's why campaigns matter, right? Is that if there's a conservative program and people don't like it, it changes the whole narrative of Canadian politics. And so as long as they don't have that, they can be rising in a poll. But if whatever they come up with is not, they haven't thought it through that well, that's when you could see a change in the tendency that we've seen in the polls that is very much dig very deep at this point. But it could change when the Conservatives are not just challenging, but actually saying something. I'm exaggerating.
No, I know what you mean. Something more specific. And you know, look, this approach has worked well for them.
Something more specific, yes.
And I don't see them switching it until they have to. But look, I do want to just quickly switch topic because we got Minister Stephen Guilbeault coming up in just a second. But they want to talk about capital gains tax rather than carbon tax. But the Prime Minister was talking about the carbon tax today in Saskatchewan, announcing that people there will continue to receive the full federal rebate despite the fact the province isn't collecting the tax on home heating. It had been previously suggested the rebates might be reduced because of less revenue being remitted. But the Environment Minister, Stephen Guilbeault, says this decision means the people of Saskatchewan is going to get the same unreduced rebate as every other Canadian gets. Just have a listen.
Four times a year, they will get the Canada Carbon Rebate, as do other Canadians and provinces where the federal system is applied, and they won't be penalized because their Premier Scott Moe, is playing politics with climate change. And the Prime Minister and I think Cabinet felt that that it wouldn't be fair for the people of Saskatchewan to pay for the irresponsible attitude of the provincial government.
Okay, I want to do a quick round on this before we take a break. But Kate, on this, you're talking about not taking bait and giving people fights they want on their terms. Yeah. By not reducing the rebate, are they not taking the bait Scott Moe wanted and giving him the political fight he wants in election, letting CRA deal with this through the tax system? Or are they kind of backing down on a threat to impose consequences on Saskatchewan because of the actions of the Premier? Where do you think this lands?
Yeah, I think it is a little bit of a middle ground. I'm not sure that it will do much to deter Scott Moe's fervor against the carbon tax.
I don't think it will.
But I'm also not sure that it's going to necessarily have the consequence of the public saying, oh, I'm so glad the government is being the bigger person here and I get my rebate. I think that, generally speaking, public opinion has shifted on this in such a way that the federal government, kind of no matter what they do at this stage, there's going to be a lot of questions about whether or not this is an effective policy, whether or not the rebate will actually, make one kind of whole considering what they might be out. So they could have forced the question a little bit harder. Again, difficult to do that when they did open the door in October to some changes.
On home heating oil.
Yeah. So that's it's been challenging for them to navigate that.
Okay, Michelle, what are your thoughts on this? It's interesting because I think it was Jonathan Wilkinson who said on the show that maybe the rebates would be reduced, and now that's not happening.
Well, let's be honest. There's not a lot of votes in Saskatchewan that are coming the Liberal way, even in the best of times, right? But I suspect that there was no good politics in this. Don't want to just take Scott Moe's bait and give him red meat and fodder for the election campaign and one more thing to rail against. And I also suspect that it would be pretty difficult to try and figure out how to do some kind of a calculation and change CRA just for the folks, the taxpayers of Saskatchewan. And, it'd probably cost more to do that than they're actually paying out to give the full rebate.
Right.
And so it was better politics. Keep it up.
Okay. Emily, a quick 30 seconds from you and then 30 seconds for Francoise. And then we have to say goodbye.
You don't want to punish the people for the action of their government. So even though the tax is not collected at this point, if it will be in the future, it would be punishing the people not to collect the rebate. And that's been the narrative coming from the criticism of the Liberal government that they are having an approach to climate policy that is about punishing individuals. So I think it's the right call for them to not do that and still offer the rebate.
Okay. Francoise, your quick final thoughts.
Very quickly, and I hope you ask Minister Guilbeault, just for my sake, is the tax still going to be charged and just not collected by nobody? It's going to be in limbo, in which case I agree. Don't penalize the public. But if it's not charged and people are receiving a check on top of it, I'm just wondering about the legal ramification and how all this gets settled in. So if it's just a question of I charge the tax, but then nobody wants the amount that I charge to somebody,
yeah,
not clear in my head, so I'm going to listen to your interview very, very, very closely.
Well, I think that's probably more a question for the Canada Revenue Agency in terms of how they're going to get it back, right? Because I think this
they're
ends
a little
up,
busy right now.
I think this ends up in federal tax court. His Majesty the King versus His Majesty the King. It's going to be quite the case. I want to thank you
Long
all.
Long live the King.
Emily Nicola, Michelle Cadario, Francois Boivin, and Kate Harrison. Thanks so much, gang.
Thank you.
See you.
Bye.
The Prime Minister says people in Saskatchewan will still get their full carbon tax rebates despite the fact the provincial government is refusing to collect and remit that tax on home heating.
Despite the disagreement I have with the provincial government here in Saskatchewan on them not wanting to pay the federal government what is owed, the Canada carbon rebate checks going to families in Saskatchewan will not be impacted by the government of Saskatchewan's decision.
Just last hour, Dustin Duncan, the Saskatchewan minister responsible for Sask Energy, reacted to this news.
Government giving back the people of Saskatchewan the money that they've collected from them on the carbon tax, I think, you know, from that standpoint, I think it's a good thing. Our view is still that they shouldn't be collecting it in the first place.
All of this comes as environmental issues get some added spotlight here in the national capital, with representatives from more than 170 countries meeting in downtown Ottawa. They're working to create a legally binding global agreement on plastics pollution. To talk about all of this, I'm joined now by the Minister of Environment and Climate Change, Stephen Guilbeault. Minister, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, David.
How did the government, how did Cabinet land on this decision not to dock the rebates going to Saskatchewan? It had been suggested by Cabinet ministers in the past that there might be a reduction in the rebate. Why decide to go with the full amount despite what's happening there?
Well, you heard from the Prime Minister. The people of Saskatchewan should not be penalized because of the irresponsibilities of the provincial government with carbon pricing, and they should, and the, as the Prime Minister said, they should still get the carbon rebate. There's no option where Saskatchewan cannot not pay what is owed to the federal government. And as the Prime Minister said, the Canadian Revenue Agency has some tools at its disposal to ensure that the money that's owed will be paid.
The last time Premier Scott Moe was on this program, he said to me that his government had been contacted by the CRA in some form about this. Is that where your government is going to leave this battle with the Canada Revenue Agency and its collection powers and maybe federal tax court and sort of avoid a political conflict or seek a political remedy to this, just leave it to the CRA?
You've heard from the Prime Minister. We have every confidence that the Canadian Revenue Agency will be able to deal with this.
There's been some question, just as a final point on this, that maybe the government should look at other options, like withholding transfers from other programs. Is that something you would consider if Saskatchewan doesn't end its defiance over collecting and remitting the carbon tax, or is that completely off the table for your government?
Let's be clear here. Saskatchewan is breaking the law, and I don't think that as a responsible government we should respond by breaking laws ourselves, by withholding transfers that are supposed to go to Saskatchewan. That's not how a country that's governed by laws should be doing its business. If Scott Moe decides that's how he wants to do it, that's not how we're going to do it at the federal level.
Okay. I want to switch, if I can, to the issue of the day where you are. You spent the day at the UN Global Plastics meeting trying to work on a treaty with representatives from more than 170 countries to create this legally binding global agreement on plastics pollution by the end of this year. You announced plans yesterday for the Federal Plastics Registry. What can you tell me about what that is designed to achieve and how that is being received today?
So you can think about it, think about this plastic registry, how one would think about the national greenhouse gas inventory report that we publish every year that allows us to see, you know, sector by sector, jurisdiction by jurisdiction in Canada, what is happening with our greenhouse gas emissions. Are we heading in the right direction? Are different sectors pulling their weight? Do we have to readjust some of our policies, measures, investment to ensure that we are getting to where we need to go when it comes to fighting climate change. We need the same type of tools to fight plastic pollution. Right now, if we were to try and measure our progress on fighting plastic pollution, we have no baseline. So that registry will allow us to know what kind of plastics are being used in Canada, where are they being used, and what happens at the end of the life of those plastics. It will be a very transparent and public instrument that experts, scientists, environmental organizations, anyone who's interested will be able to have access to and to see what is happening with the production and use of plastics in Canada.
So could this eventually lead to a reduction in plastic production, Minister? Because we measure emissions as a way of finding ways to reduce emissions. And I know this is about plastic pollution and not plastics in totality. But groups like Greenpeace have been asking for a reduction in the amount of plastics being produced as a way to curb waste. Is that part of where this is going?
So just so people understand where we're coming from, 2 years ago in Nairobi, all of the world's countries agreed that we wanted to fight plastic pollution. In fact, we wanted to have an internationally legally binding treaty by the end of 2024, so at the end of this year, to ensure that by 2040, we have eliminated plastic pollution. So not the use of plastics. Obviously, plastics play a very important role in our society in a number of applications, airplanes, appliances, the medical sector. But clearly, they are those plastics that we should get rid of because they can't be recycled, which is why Canada has put in place a ban on single-use plastics. Many other nations are doing that as well. For those plastics that are playing this very essential role in our society, we need to make sure that we give those plastic value so that they stay in the economy and they stay out of our environment and more out of human bodies, because there's a emerging body of scientific evidence that we are finding plastic pollution in our brains, in our bloodstreams, in the placenta of women. So it's not only an environmental catastrophe, but it's becoming a public health crisis.
Right, and certainly you're going to need plastic products for the electric vehicles we're going to make, and the part of that transition you're going to need them for medical procedures.
That's correct.
But you mentioned the ban on single-use plastics. This was overturned by a court here in Canada, your order on that, and I know you're appealing that. But how does that legal setback and uncertainty affect your ability to make commitments in a global treaty when you have this domestic challenge at play?
So we have appealed the decision by the federal court judge, and we've asked for a stay of that judgment as well. So the regulation still applies in Canada. Talking with ministers from all around the world, everyone is, you know, these are challenging things to do. We are trying to change the way we regulate plastics, and it's not something we've done collectively ever, and we've been using plastics for decades and decades. So, you know, to think that Canada is the only country that is facing some challenges in deploying solutions and in trying to change things, it's not the case. It is challenging in many countries, and I think the purpose of bringing all these countries together so that we can work on common policies and measures on things that everyone or close to everyone around the world will be putting in place will make it easier for us to do that, because right now it's a handful of countries that are doing things like ban on single-use plastic. But when it's 150 countries, or almost 200 countries, then it is going to be much easier to do that.
You know, we've talked in the past, about COP and the ambition targets set on emission reductions globally, and some of the challenges that maybe some of the targets are too aspirational to meet in the timeframes that have been set for them and the challenges that creates. And we saw coming in to this conversation some of the delegates from the United States saying they don't want to come up with something on a plastics treaty that is too ambitious and we can't hit that target. They want something that is more realistic and achievable. Where do you stand on that? Is a slightly less ambitious treaty acceptable from a Canadian position if it gets you to an agreement that people can commit to?
I think I would respectfully disagree with our colleagues from the United States. I think that we have to be ambitious because science demands that we're ambitious. And it's probably an area where the Canadian public and frankly the public around the world is more seized with. When we're talking about things like, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, it's very intangible. People can't really see it. But when you're talking about plastic pollution, people see it. They see it in the streets. They see it when they go and walk in the forest, when they're at the beach, either here in Canada or abroad. So it's very tangible for the public. And there is, we're being pushed by our public in Canada, in the United States, in Europe, in Asia, in Latin America, in Africa, to do better as governments when it comes to fighting plastic pollution. So science is demanding it. Our public is demanding it. And there are lots of alternatives. I've been meeting with companies that are developing alternatives to single-use plastics, for example, to better recycling methods from the get-go, to design plastics that will be easier to be reused and reused in the economy. So these things are possible, and I think we can do that.
So, Minister, just as a final point, while you try to figure out how to manage plastics going forward, there is still the challenge of today. And a lot of plastics that people think are going to recycling here in Canada get shipped overseas and end up in Myanmar and the Philippines and don't actually get treated with well. And the criticism has been people use export loopholes by going through other countries to be able to do that with plastic waste in this country. And it just moves the problem somewhere else. Is this something you need to get a handle on as a government to limit the overseas export of plastic waste from Canada and have it not be recycled and just become somebody else's garbage?
So in Canada, we're recycling about 9% of our plastics, which is what is happening on average around the world. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the exports of plastics, there's two issues. Canada will be, we are working to ratify another UN treaty to ensure that if we are exporting products abroad, these products can be recycled. Then there's the issue of black market exports. And we know that some companies are not being particularly careful when it comes to that, then trying to circumvent our laws and regulations. So we need to do better on that as well. Obviously, controlling the black market is a bit more complicated, but certainly something we're very seized with as well.
Okay. Minister of Environment and Climate Change, Stephen Gilbo, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it, sir.
Thank you very much, David. Bye-bye.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.